Joint Interim Task Force on Reserve Funds for January 31st, 2017. The principal purpose of this hearing today is to hear a presentation by representatives from the Pew Charitable Trust. There'll be plenty of time for questions during the presentation, so we won't wait till the very end of it. So if you have any questions, please ask them. And anything from the highly competent staff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I think we do have a slide presentation here that Mr. Bailey's going to go through, and then we would like to just thank them in advance. They've done a lot of work on this over the last several months, and we're just very appreciative of what they've been providing to us.
Okay. So, Mr. Bailey, would you please identify yourself for the record and begin at your convenience?
Absolutely. My name is Steve Bailey. I'm a senior researcher with the Pew Charitable Trust. And I want to thank you, Chairman Devlin, Chairwoman Nathanson, and members of the committee for having me here today again. This past summer, my colleague Robert Zarednick and I spoke about Pew's best practices related to reserve funds, and specifically how savings policies can best mitigate volatility. And that's something that Oregon knows a lot about. We focused on certain aspects of reserve fund policy in particular to help the task force meet its goals. And so what you're seeing here is the goals of the task force, which we have divided into three distinct categories. And for my presentation today, I just want to really briefly overview some of the really key talking points that we covered last meeting, about revenue volatility. But then I want to spend a majority of my presentation walking through specific findings and recommendations related to fund size, deposit rules, and withdrawal rules that could better align Oregon's reserve fund policy with Pew's best practices. And so, as the chairman said, feel free to interrupt me at any time. I'm going to be talking about trend lines and revenue fluctuations that can get complicated, and so feel free to slow me down or feel free to interrupt at any time. And so to start, let's just take a visual look at Oregon's volatility. And when people talk about volatility, a lot of time they're thinking about tax revenue volatility. However, before you can talk about tax volatility, you need to take a step back and analyze the state's economic volatility. And that's because economic volatility is a large driver of tax volatility. The larger that the economic fluctuations are, the more likely your tax revenue is going to fluctuate regardless of your tax policy. And so to do that, I want to show you a picture of state economic fluctuations over the past 25 years. Now, there's a lot of different ways to measure economic growth, but one of the measures we like the best is called the coincident index. And this combines a few different economic variables related to income and employment. So here you see the annual changes in total U.S. state coincident index. You can see the cyclical pattern, the economic growth in between recessions, and with drops occurring where you would expect, especially during the Great Recession in 2008. And this next graph I'm showing is Oregon's economic growth compared to the U.S. And the overall pattern, it's the same, but the peaks and valleys are more intense. And this might not be a surprise to you. Oregon and the West in general is a little more dynamic than some of the other regions. So even before you're considering your tax policy, Oregon's underlying economic fluctuations are going to be more volatile than the nation as a whole. So does this pattern hold when we're looking at tax revenue? Well, this is a graph that looks at state tax fluctuations over the last 20 years. So first here is a line graph of total U.S. tax fluctuations, combining the revenue numbers for all 50 states. And again, much like the economic data you saw before, you can see the cyclical ups and downs of the revenue cycle. And now let's graph Oregon's annual total tax revenue fluctuations. And it is the same general cyclical cycle again, but look at how much more volatile and jumpy these changes can be. In fact, we found that Oregon's total taxes are the 16th most volatile in the nation over the past 20 years. And one caveat to that number, that comparison in this graph is based on total tax revenue, not just Oregon's general fund. If you were to look at just Oregon's general fund revenue, the state has the 8th most volatile revenues by that same measure. In fact, Oregon is one of the most volatile states that does not have severance tax as a major tax stream. So severance tax, oil, gas, coal. So we've talked about
clarification there.
Yes.
When you said that they would be eighth, And could you talk a little bit about the first seven states, about what makes them more volatile? I think you've kind of implied what makes them more volatile.
Yeah.
But could you state that a little bit more clearly?
Absolutely. If you look at Pew as a measure, it's called the Fiscal 50 Volatility Indicator. And basically, we look at every state's major tax, and we see what states have the most volatile total taxes. And for the top echelon, the things that are most in common are they get a majority of their taxes or a major chunk of their taxes from oil or gas revenue. So North Dakota, think Alaska, think Wyoming. These are the states that are especially volatile. And then you get to this level of states that don't have that, and Oregon's right at the top. California as well is pretty high, and that's usually thought of as a pretty volatile state. And these are states that a lot of their income might be indirectly or directly related to personal income. So think capital gains. It might be related to corporate income. These are taxes that are just not as predictable on a year-to-year basis. And so we always say that your tax policy you do for a lot of reasons, but certain taxes can just by their very nature be more volatile. And so we've looked at economic and revenue volatility, but now let's just look at the size of the state's reserves, which are vital to mitigating these fluctuations. And this bar graph shows the combined size of the Rainy Day Fund and the Education Stability Funds, the two funds the task force was asked to examine. Now, the actual size of the funds over time in relation to the percentage of the biennial budget is in blue, and then the maximum size of the funds is that remaining area in white. So just to orientate you with this graph, you can see in 2008 the actual balance and the maximum balance shot up, and this was due to the creation of the Rainy Day Fund. And you can see the funds were almost completely drained in 2011, and the state has done a consistent job of rebuilding the funds since 2013. In fact, Oregon is one of only a few states that has fully rebuilt its reserves to pre-recession levels. And so the natural question then, is that enough? Are the maximum levels set enough? And so what I want to do is walk you through an analysis Pew did of Oregon's revenue volatility to help answer that question. And when we're looking at the adequacy of reserve funds, we apply a stress test to your revenues. And this means that we're going to simulate different recession scenarios and see how much in reserve the state would need for each scenario. So here are the parameters for two of those scenarios.
Can you go back one for a second? I just had a question.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's maybe a little bit too specific, but in 2008, where our reserve funds were up at that level as a percentage of biennial receipts, was, since it's a percentage, was that number would have been slightly inflated because our revenue had dropped precipitously. So in terms of the relationship to our reserves to our funds, mm-hmm.
That's
it's
a great
probably looking better than it actually was, in a sense, because our funds were dropping precipitously at the time. So as a percentage of revenue, it looked higher, but the absolute number is, that's probably not a real reflection, in a sense, of what the reality was.
No, that's a great question, and a lot of states found that after the Great Recession, well, a lot of states kind of set this maximum cap level for their reserves, and they found that during the recession, ironically, they had gone over their cap because a lot of the states set their cap to be a percentage of revenues. So when revenues go down, absolutely.
Okay.
And so going back to this, we analyze first an average recession. In this scenario, revenues fall by a typical amount. So think like during the recession in the early 2000s. So in this scenario, we're going to assume that it takes revenues 5 years to fully recover to their normal growth rate. And we're also going to assume that the state wants to fill the entire revenue downturn with reserves, not spending cuts or tax increases. So again, these are just scenarios you might want to build in different assumptions. And the second scenario we ran is what we call the severe recession, so think Great Recession. And in this scenario is similar to the last scenario I presented, except revenues fall more dramatically. In this scenario, we want reserves that could cover all but the worst possible recession. So how did we perform this analysis? Well, we used a technique that was first pioneered by Minnesota's budget office. So first, we separate out each of Oregon's general fund tax streams. For example, here you see graph the annual fluctuations of personal income. And we analyze how much personal income fluctuates from its average growth rate. We also analyze how quickly it takes personal income to snap back after it falls below average. And we also weigh personal income based on how much of the total general fund it comprises. So personal income comprises a lot of Oregon's general fund, and so we weigh this a little heavier. And we do this for every tax then. And so here's a graph of corporate income and excise taxes. And then finally, here's a graph of the other smaller taxes that make up the general fund. And so throughout this analysis, we calculate how much of these tax streams correlate with each other as well, meaning whether they tend to go up or down together or they're not related at all. And so from there, we applied our scenarios from the previous slide. And we asked, how much do these tax streams go down during an average recession, and what about a severe recession? So I'm going back to that slide before of the combined size of reserve funds for rainy day funds and the Education Stability Fund. And according to our analysis, Oregon needs just over 4% of biennial revenues in reserves to offset the average recession we presented. And as you can see, it's estimated that the state will have a little over that level at the close of this fiscal year. And when we looked at our severe recession scenario, we found that Oregon needs approximately 8% of biennium revenues in reserves to offset that scenario I presented. And so while the state's actual rainy day fund reserves are still well below that level, it appears that the current maximum cap on the rainy day fund and the Education Stability Fund would not prevent the funds from meeting that target. And so now we've talked about fund size, and now I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about how the state builds those reserves. And I have listed here the deposit rules for the state's rainy day fund and the Education Stability Fund. The primary deposit rule for rainy day fund is ending balance for the biennium. We call this a deposit rule based on end of year surplus. It can also receive additional deposits as the state elected to do in 2000 when it created the fund. The Education Stability Fund receives 18% of lottery earnings each year, and we call this a static deposit rule since the level of annual deposits don't fluctuate that much from year to year. And while this rule is not directly tied to volatility, it does provide the state with some consistent savings from year to year. So what I want to focus on and what Pew believes can be reformed to better be tied to volatility is the main rainy day fund deposit rule, up to 1% of ending fund balances for the biennium. And rules based on ending surplus are common across the 50 states, but they also can make savings a low priority. Oftentimes, a state will use some of projecting ending balances for programs or tax cuts before they're considering how much to save. And so, in other words, it makes the savings policy a little reactive. And having a proactive savings policy is something that we think is important for all states, and it's something we talk about in all states, but it's especially important in Oregon, and that's only because in some years of high revenue growth, which are going to be ideal for savings, the state's kicker law directs back money to the taxpayers. Now, Pew has no position on the kicker law. However, it does obviously add an extra complication to savings. So this is why – oh, sorry.
Can you go a little bit deeper into that? I mean, I think most of the members up here understand that, but one of the difficulties we obviously have is if you were going to set aside funds when you have unpredicted growth in revenue, which is or it's higher than normally what you would expect, and if we have not accurately predicted it well in advance, our kicker law would come into effect, and you could have a very real scenario where under the law you would be required to make a deposit into the reserve, but at the same time under the law you would be required to give those additional funds back to taxpayers.
Absolutely. And actually, if you don't mind, I think my next slide might cover that a little bit, and then we can have a more robust discussion about it. And so graphed here is what it I'll actually go back to that. It is a tough balance. In most states we would recommend that states deposit above trend revenue, which is what I'm going to show you. So basically, when revenue is above average, we recommend the state deposit a portion of that. But a lot of times when revenue is above average, it's also might exceed the revenue forecast, which will build in that kicker law. So it's a little more complicated. So the next couple slides I'm going to walk through is how and if a scenario where you were to tie your deposits to above-trend revenue growth could actually work in the kicker with the kicker law in place. Mm. So graphed here is Oregon's biennial general fund revenue fluctuation since 2003. And so you can see the dip during the Great Recession as well as the recovery afterward. And now what I'm going to do is graph the average growth rate over that same time period, this dotted black line. And now a rule that was tied to volatility, as we just talked about, would essentially set aside a percentage of biennial revenue that is above this average. And so we asked ourselves at Pew, how much would Oregon have effectively saved if they had set aside 75% of this above-trend revenue? Well, here you see again the same graph as before. I've just moved it up slightly. And below, I'm going to graph the amount that would be set aside in the rainy day fund each year if 75% of above-trend revenue was saved. And this is a very similar rule to one that they have in Virginia that's very popular. Now, in most states, again, that's all we would do to model the savings rule. But because of the kicker law, I'm also going to show you how much of that above-trend revenue the kicker effectively took up. And I'm doing this because we just wanted to know if the kicker law, again, could work with our savings rule. And so graph below is 75% of all above-trend revenue in a given year. In a biennium where there is no kicker, all you see is the blue level of savings recommended to go towards the rainy day fund. In years when there was a kicker, we show the actual historic kicker amount in green to give you an idea of basically the realized savings less the kicker law. And so, for example, from 2003 to 2015, in that biennium, there was no kicker, and all 75% of the above-trend revenue, approximately $1 million, would go to the rainy day fund. In the 2005-2007 biennium, there was over $1.3 billion in above-trend revenue. But since over $1 billion went out through the kicker, we're effectively saying that the savings to the rainy day fund that year would have been closer to $238 million with our deposit rule. And so the big takeaway, I think, from this counterfactual is that a savings policy tied to above-trend revenue growth, there's a lot of overlap there, obviously. When revenue is above trend, a lot of times revenue will go out to the kicker law, in effect. But it can also be effective. For example, from 2011 to 2017, the effective savings, if you add up all those in blue, to the rainy day fund would have been $425 million. And that's even including taking out all those green impacts of the kicker law. So so while this is very unique, we think that this proactive savings policy could still work in some way in Oregon. And again, this 75% example and the trend line I've set are just examples. We can walk through different scenarios later and send those out to you guys later in a memo.
So I just want to clarify. Absolutely. So the chart, the growth rate, so all we're talking about is a percentage above the revenue from the previous biennium. It's the amount of money doesn't make any difference. It's just that the amount that it changes over the previous year in a percentage.
Exactly.
The trend, even though we talk about having increased revenues, but the trend is in the wrong direction.
That's correct. When we look at revenue trend lines, what we like to do is we like to kind of look beyond the year to year and look a little more holistically where you are in the business cycle. That's kind of the whole ethos of saving based off of volatility. You're not just saving based on where you might end up. Mm-hmm. You're saving if revenues are above average. And that's just because when revenues are above average, they're by definition not sustainable. So we like to save a little bit of that above average revenues, knowing they might fall down.
Mm. If I could, let's go to the years 11, 13 through 15, 17. So if I was to extrapolate from this, how this would work. In that period of time, which is where we've actually rebuilt the reserve funds, mm-hmm. and we at the end of 17 we will have a little bit less than $800 million. You're saying that we would probably have about, if we consistently had followed this, we would have had about one point, you're presuming we'd still put the money in the reserve funds that we already do. So if we already did that, you would presume that we might have as much as $1.2 billion in the reserve funds at this point.
It's possible. When you go back with those kind of counterfactuals, it's tough. But and we might want to replace the surplus deposit rule, but we under this rule, it would have saved a little more than what you did save.
Okay. But you're not saying then that there'll be cumulative.
I think that if Again, this is just counterfactual, but what we had in mind is that you would replace your surplus rule with something based more proactively on volatility. So it wouldn't be a total addition.
So if I can go back, since half of our reserves come from a dedication of lottery funds to the Education Stability Fund, if we replaced it with this, it might be a better system. I'm just doing the math there. We would have approximately about the same in reserves.
I think that's a great question.
Yeah.
I think that when we look at, when we're talking about changing the deposit rule, we would keep the Education Stability Fund rule the same. And then just when I'm talking about these savings changes, it would just be to the rainy day
fund. I'm just doing the simple math of this because they're about equal right now. They're a little bit apart, but
absolutely.
But in a sense, you'd keep the Education Stability Fund if you had this in its place instead of leaving, always doing the automatic deposit of 1% ending fund balance. You did this, you'd be in a similar situation probably, and because you said this would be about $400 million.
Roughly. 425, correct.
Yeah,
yes.
A little bit slightly more than we have. But it would be a better system than what we have, or at least it would more deal with our volatility.
I think so, but that's a great point. And in terms of what you've added to the rainy day fund, I could be wrong, but I believe it's about $350 million over the past few years, or perhaps a little less. But yeah, absolutely. It would be, we think, a little more holistic system, but in terms of the actual outcomes, you would have added maybe 50 more under this scenario for those years you pointed out. And so we can always go back to this. I know that this is complicated, and we, at the end, I'm going to go through recommendations where we talk about maybe not being this prescriptive and maybe more just building in more above-trend revenue estimates into the forecasting process. So when you're building the budget, you have a little more aware of what revenue is above trend and below trend. And so we focused on deposit rules. And now, really quickly, I just want to go to the other end of the coin and look at withdrawal rules. So Oregon's Rainy Day Fund and the Education Stability Fund both have three common withdrawal triggers. So one is tied to economic volatility, and this is a strong rule that allows withdrawals if there are a decline in non-farm payroll employments. We like at least states having one rule that's tied to economic volatility. We think this is a really good practice. And another is tied to forecast error, so that second bullet point. So many states have this rule when revenues fall below the initial forecast. We don't necessarily quantify this as a best practice, but we think it makes a lot of sense for Oregon to have this rule. So what I want to focus on is this third trigger. And this trigger is tied to projected revenue volatility. And having this type of rule is also a best practice, according to our research, since the trigger is linked directly to revenue performance. The question for us was whether this trigger level, a 3% or more decline in biennial revenues, is adequate given Oregon's experience with revenue volatility. So you saw this graph before. Shown here is a change in general fund biennium revenues since 2013, as well as a line that shows just the average fluctuation over that same time. And now what I'm just drawing in green is the level of projected revenue decline needed for that withdrawal trigger that I just talked about to be hit. And most states, about eight states, have this type of rule that Oregon does, and most states set this trigger level at 0%. Others consider sluggish growth, like a 2% increase in revenue, enough to trigger possible reserve fund use. But at 3% or more of projected revenue decline, Oregon actually has the strictest rule among states that use this type of withdrawal mechanism. And obviously, caution is really important when you're using your rainy day fund. But the question for us was whether a negative 3% growth rate is responsive enough to Oregon. For example, if revenue was projected to decline by 1%, what would that mean for the state budget? Because currently the state would not be able to use reserves in that scenario. So we were just kind of walking through, and we thought the state might want to relook at what that trigger level was at, even though we like the mechanism itself. So just to summarize our findings and our recommendations, first, we believe that the state should consider above-trend revenue when saving to the rainy day fund. And this ensures a few things: that savings is tied to those growth periods instead of baking it into the recurring budget. And a lot of times when states are using above-trend revenue for recurring items, you can kind of create a structural problem without even knowing it. So a more holistic savings policy now and in the future might help Oregon in terms of better aligning its recurring revenues with its recurring costs, as well as building a decent reserve fund size. But you also have different options. I talked about changing the savings rule for the rainy day fund from a surplus rule to one that is tied to volatility. But you could also consider building in information related to whether reserves are above trend or below trend into your revenue and economic forecast, just to help guide the budget process throughout the year. In Utah, for example, the state's legislative fiscal analyst reports what revenue is above the 15-year average trend line. And legislators are in turn directed under the legislative joint rules to consider that above-trend revenue as one-time in nature. So they can do a lot of things with it, such as capital projects or savings. But in general, they're directed to, if they can, treat that revenue as one-time in nature. And as a second recommendation, we find that Oregon's withdrawal trigger tied to projected revenue growth is the strictest among states with this rule. So given the state's typical growth rate, the task force might consider reassessing the proper threshold under that withdrawal condition. And finally, that reserve fund analysis, after doing an analysis of revenue volatility and that econometric calculation based on the methodology pioneered by Minnesota's budget office, Pew finds that Oregon's maximum allowable balance for the rainy day fund and education stability fund combined would be enough to offset a severe recession. And so I know I went over a lot, and I appreciate your questions, Dorian, but happy to answer any questions now or go back to any slides at all. And thank you so much for your time.
Yeah.
So I want to go back to to understand a little bit more of the scenario. So in the severe recession, and where it takes, again, it's the five-year recovery, what you're saying that our projected or our reserves that we already have identified that we would, the level we'd have, that we could during that time by using the reserves maintain, I'm going to go back to the discussion about all those other costs that change though, but we could maintain kind of current service, I mean current government. Mm-hmm. No changes up or down necessarily, but we'd have an adequate money to make those investments over that five-year period it takes to recover with the reserve amounts we've identified that we would like to obtain.
With the ones that you'd like to obtain, if you were to hit that all the way up at that white line,
yeah,
then yes, you'd be able to. And 10% of biennial revenues is actually a really high amount in reserves. Most states look at the amount they're saving in terms of annual revenues, so we would double that 10% to 20%. And very few states have in reserves 20%. You think more of those severance tax states I talked about,
right,
that really see the bottom fall out. So if the state were to obtain 10% in reserves in those two funds, and again, we didn't even look at ending fund balance here, but just those two funds, then according to our analysis, they would have enough to maintain current service or to maintain all the shortfall below the average growth rate for 5 years.
Right. Yeah, thank you.
Can I clarify something on your third recommendation?
Yeah.
Now, you said we had about the strictest standard in this particular area. Is there any implication here that you should have? I mean, when I think of a reduction in revenue, the most common way people think a reduction in revenue is a reduction in revenue from what you had in the previous biennium or in the previous fiscal year. Should you be thinking about a reduction in revenue from what you would think would be your normal growth in revenue versus, because I think part of our issue in this particular biennium is, and you saw it there on the graph, the declining level of growth. If we had the same level of growth in 13-15 that we now have in 17-19, we would be in a different fiscal position than we are. I'm not saying that you'd ever be guaranteed 12% growth, 12 or 13% growth. But if you were to say normal for you would be 8% growth per biennium, would you adjust, could you put in place a trigger that would trigger when you fell below that target level? I mean, you're trying to account for what are the underlying cost factors. And I'm just wondering if there's any states that look at it that way. It's a little bit different than looking at what your growth is
from one biennium to the next or one fiscal year to the next, you know.
That's a great question, actually. When we think about, in the most perfect world, the perfect budget stabilization fund, for us it's one that you're really proactively savings when you're above that, and that means that you can use a little more proactively that money when it falls below. The problem is that few states really have that perfect balance between being able to save everything when revenues are above and then use everything when revenues are below. No state has a withdrawal trigger that's tied to exactly to their growth rate, unfortunately. The closest one is in Arkansas. They have their triggers set at 3% growth. They thought that for them that would put enough budget strain on there.
3% annually or biennially?
Annually. So it's projected that revenue is going to grow less than 3% annually. They do have the option of using their rainy day fund. And for them, that was an appropriate trigger because they thought that would put enough budget pressure that they'd be able to use the funds. That's a really good question. In a perfect world, I think that's how that mechanism would operate with a budget stabilization fund, that you would have be able to use it very proactively. But again, it's very rarely are you going to be able to fully fill any downturn below average with your current reserves.
Yes, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. I'd like to talk about this from a little bit different point of view. So when we look at these numbers in the hundreds of millions or billions, it's sort of like, well, then what's the point? Okay, so you would explain to the public, instead of saving $325 million, we could save $574 million. But what does that mean, really? What does that represent? Does that mean government keeps delivering all the programs and services exactly like they are until the next biennium? Does it mean you can keep going for a month before you have to shut down totally? What does that number actually mean as far as providing services to the citizens of Oregon? And in other situations some years ago, people used to explain, well, you need to have enough savings to operate for 4 weeks or 2 months. Well, and then what, you shut down totally? Or it's enough to allow you time to reconvene and then adjust your budget accordingly? So help me understand what are we supposed to say to people? It's a good thing or a bad thing if you can save $30 million more or $300 million more? How much better off are you?
That's a really good question. A lot of states, especially now, we find are really struggling with what the purpose of their rainy day fund is. And that's because a lot of states, much like Oregon is now, are going through times when they're not in a recession, but they still are facing some really big budget pressures and some revenue declines in some states, especially states that collect severance tax. So they're just wondering, what is the purpose of our rainy day fund? And in truth, Pew doesn't have a lot of direct guidance about the purpose. Every state can be different, but for example, these recession scenarios that I presented have some assumptions, and they kind of walk through. Basically, you can imply a purpose through this, that if I were to say recession scenario one, then we could say that this will help us mitigate an average recession, and we will be able to offset downturns for 5 years. And so in times when we can least afford it, we won't have to cut those services. So at least for us, rainy day funds aren't meant to be your saving and then never using it again. You're just saving, then using that money for a different time when you need it more. So it's not really hoarding, which is why we think that both looking at the deposit rules and the withdrawal rules are important. It really is about finding the time when revenue growth isn't that sustainable and not hoarding it forever, but knowing that we have to save some of that, because we know there's going to be times when revenue growth is below average, and that's when we're going to kind of just move that revenue to the next fiscal year, and that'll help us help services going, avoid tax increases at times when taxpayers can least afford it and citizens can least afford it. So I think when you kind of frame it in terms of the bigger business cycle and the inevitability of the ups and downs, that it's really just being proactive with your dollars that you're seeing that year. But I will say that a lot of states are really struggling with that purpose. And if every state house and every legislator a lot of times has a different idea of what the rainy day fund is for. And I think having that conversation is really important, whether it is explicitly laying out these scenarios, this is why we're saving, so we can set very precise saving levels. We had to make a lot of assumptions here when we were making these savings levels. If we said that we only wanted to cover 2 years worth of recession, these numbers would be different. If we wanted to cover an even more extreme scenario than a severe recession, something that would be a really huge anomaly, then this would be saving even more. So having those conversations out loud is a really important start, but it's a great question.
Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was thinking about this question before Representative Nathanson's question, but in some ways it's almost a follow-up. The United States economy and the Oregon economy have been in a long-term growth pattern with accentuated with recessions that are pretty short, sometimes pretty severe, until 2007 from the end of World War II. Now, we've been in a very slow, long recovery with very, very low growth rates in at least in the fiscal area for the period of time since 2008. As you look at these recommendations, how are you taking into account the fact that the fiscal world in which we live seems to have either taken a break or it's changed? It's hard to tell exactly, and what the implications of that are. Now, I'll tell you one of the insights that leads me to ask this question is that Oregon right now is significantly behind in its reserves for the public employee retirement system. One of the reasons why we're significantly behind is that the growth rate we've actually had is significantly below the growth rate expected in the structure of the pension plan. I don't think anybody much talks about that, but that's the reality, and of course it's also true in other states. Any insights on that comment of mine? I don't mean the specific comment about PERS. I mean the more general issue having to do with the way the economy appears to have changed its pattern.
Yeah. Paul, where are you? I'm just kidding. There's a really good article that just came out in Governing where they talked about states struggle to save, just going back to savings and how they're not seeing if we were to go back, the booms that they're used to seeing that Oregon saw in 2006, that they're not there, that those obvious opportunities to save aren't there. A lot of times they're chugging along a little below what you normally would expect or a little bit above, but those natural points to save you're not really seeing anymore, and we're seeing that in a lot of states. So I can't speak, unfortunately, I don't think very eloquently to Oregon's particular revenue situation and long-term outlook, but I can say that what we're seeing in every state, minus a few, is just this kind of pressure where states know they need to save. We just went through the Great Recession, and they know the importance of savings, but revenues aren't really moving along at the normal level you'd expect. So you're really running into these natural conflicts, and it's really hard to decide what the priorities are in between services, tax cuts, and savings. And so I'm sorry that doesn't fully answer your question, but I can send you the Governing article where I think they try to provide some insight into kind of what other states are dealing with in terms of their savings levels and those revenue pressures and the revenues, lack of dynamic revenue growth over the past couple of years.
Well, if I could follow up on that, thank you. When we had that long period of significant growth punctuated with recessions that were fairly short, the system of reserves that you've been describing made a lot of sense, because you'd in the good years you'd save some money, and in the bad years you'd spend it, and then things would get better and you'd get back to your earlier growth rate. You asked the question, or other states apparently have asked the question, what's the point of reserves? Of course, if the world has changed in a significant way, then that's a really good question to ask, because the need for reserves is different than it was in that earlier time. I think that perhaps you've already given us some hint about this when you suggest that the growth rate of revenue is something we ought to consider as we talk about this issue. The problem, of course, is that the growth rate of revenue is well below our need for simple, ordinary increases in expenditures based on current programs. And that's been true now for several years. Any insight into that issue and how it applies to the report you're giving us?
One of the best kind of savings rules that are tied to volatility are ones that adjust. So I talked about Virginia's and how that's kind of a gold standard, at least for us, and that trend line is based on their 6-year average growth rate. Mm. And so that's kind of constantly adjusting. And some states, I talked about Utah having a 15-year trend line. That's going to be a longer trend line, so it's not going to it's going to be more stable if there's a one-time blip, but it's also not going to change if there is a structural change in revenues. So there's pros and cons of having different size trend lines, and there's more complicated trend lines you could run. But in general, we find that the best rules are those states that have set some kind of either recurring evaluation of what that growth rate trigger should be, or states that have already built in a moving trend line, like Virginia, the 6-year average that I talked about. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sure.
Just inside, and then going to a question. I mean, in terms of our unfunded liability and our public employee system, you could probably look at our benefit structure. You could probably look at our inability on a consistent basis in recent years to meet our assumed rate of return. But I think nobody should lose sight of the fact of what happens when you lose $17 billion of all of your assets in 1 year, and which is 27% of all of your assets in 1 year.
That's the other side of this problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very hard to make that up. But the other question I had, in terms of your, I forget your exact terminology, but modest versus severe recession, there have to be numbers that go along with that. What sort of numbers did you use to define modest versus severe, or perhaps the length of the recovery also came into it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So when we and not that I was afraid you were going to ask that, but I was going to save the technical explanation in case there was a question about it. Essentially, what we do is we look back historically on what your revenues have been, and then we essentially apply a standard deviation band to it. So we're saying in the most severe recession, we're looking at your actual historic revenues. We're putting what's called standard deviation. So we're seeing how much, if you can think back to the statistics days, we're basically running a model that's going to show based on the number of observations we have, how bad can this really get? What confidence intervals and kind of building that out to figure out in 9 out of 10, so kind of think about that scientific experiment, we're 90% confident that we're within this range. We're basically building confidence intervals on your revenues. And so when we say a severe recession, we're saying that we're 90% confident that revenues are, that we can cover any kind of recession that you could possibly face.
Additional questions from the committee?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to, that the chart you showed before about the trend line, so I just have a question regarding, because the volatility that we saw before, I mean, the frequency seemed to be more, but what that trend line that we're showing out there at the end, though, which is headed down. So I guess I'm trying to understand what has changed. I mean, is this a significant change in the economy that line seems to be going down, where before they go up and down the peaks and the valleys are larger. But now out here, if we're looking out, and I don't know how many years that is.
Hey, I apologize. This only goes out to 2014, actually.
So, okay, so then I guess the question I have, what's happening at, I'm just trying to understand, so where's that line headed when we're having these conversations?
And let me go back to the biennial revenue mark, if you don't mind, because that goes a little further out, even though that's biennial versus annual.
But it's still headed down.
And I don't know if I'm the best person to speak to the long-term trajectory and projections of Oregon's revenue. I think reading the revenue forecast report, it does seem like just naturally over the next 10 years, 20 years, there are just naturally downward pressures as baby boomers age out and as more people retire. But I don't specifically know what's sure. driving the downward trajectory, unfortunately.
But that's, from my standpoint, that's really a part of the conversation when we're talking about these levels. It has part of the whole conversation about new revenues potentially, but just with the current revenues, even though from a perspective they may be increasing over what they were the previous, but the trend, unfortunately, the percentage trend is going the wrong direction.
Yeah, and if you're in a new, just generally not speaking about Oregon, but if you're in a new structural climate, as a representative was saying before,
right.
then you really do have to analyze your what might be that trend level.
Any additional questions from the members of the task force? Well, thank you very much. I think we very much appreciate the work the Pew Charitable Trust has done. We look forward to future assistance from the Pew Charitable Trust in this endeavor. For this particular task force, we've managed to only have actually three meetings in about a year and a half. And almost everybody on this dais actually signed on to the original bill that created the task force. And I don't think our work is really done. So I think the intent is to have a report done at this stage and probably to decide what the future of this is during this session. Is that fairly accurate?
I think, Mr. Chair, that we were considering looking at the materials that have been provided to the committee, mostly through Pew, and transmitting those to the presiding officers with a memo, a letter summarizing what you have found through these discussions, and including the recommendations that Pew has made for maybe modifying the future of our two reserve funds. And I think we were planning on doing that over the next several weeks and then having you present that information to the presiding officers with a statement that the task force has concluded its current work, but maybe not future work, because this was a bill that was structured up to a point, and that point has now happened. So I'm sure there's going to be future discussions about this because, I believe that there are some interesting things that the Pew has presented on ways that we may look at modifying one or both of our reserve funds.
Okay. Senator Hanson.
Well, I guess that's my question. Maybe that's the future discussion you're talking about, but what would those recommendations actually look like if we change? I mean, we've got three bullet points up there, but how does that translate into changes?
Well, Mr. Chair, since you're not saying anything, I'll jump in here. Or are you ready to say something?
Well, I think the one thing
that I'm looking at is the one chart that on the deposit rules that compares the average growth rate, and it shows, I think, one of the pressures we have now, and it gets back to this whole idea of what's the purpose of reserve funds. Should you use a reserve fund in times of slow revenue growth or not? Should you use a reserve fund if you have a new initiative that you want to fund or not? Or should you only use it in times of severe recession or not? And I think that's one of the things that should be discussed, because even our current situation where we're looking at a budget gap of $1.8 billion, that's despite the fact that revenues have increased $1.2 billion. So in this situation, it could be possible with a change in the rules of when you use it that we could tap into the reserve funds just to, even though revenue is growing and the other triggers aren't met, that we could actually use it on a temporary basis to just restore current kinds of program levels. But coupled with that, though, I think is a more aggressive deposit strategy in times when you do have money. And I think despite the kicker law, I think there are other things that you could do and make it more of a strict kind of decision making when you're building the budget to make sure you set aside enough to make a deposit to the rainy day fund or an extra deposit even. And I know in helping craft the co-chair's budget, which is, and I'm not getting into other budgets right now, but I would say the governor's budget that's proposed does not have enough in it to deposit the full amount into the rainy day fund. The co-chairs, however, decided no, that was important, and they said we have to budget to maintain at least that amount that should be statutorily deposited into the rainy day fund. So I think that's another place where there is room to have a discussion about deposit rules also. So.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the remarks we just heard are absolutely on point, and the issue, it seems to me this report presents us with the opportunity to have the exact discussion that I think would be of greatest interest from what we just heard. I think there's a great opportunity here to have a really productive discussion. We should have it, but I don't know when.
Well, hopefully we can convince people that it's important enough to have the discussion to actually do something with it. I follow on to the same comments as Mr. Rocco. I mean, I think it's we probably should be doing something more to look at the revenue trends and putting more away at those times if at all possible. It's kind of interesting because our deposits are virtually automatic in a sense, since we try to keep 1% so we can make the deposit. There also may be other reasons beyond the reserve funds to keep 1% at the end, because it has a very interesting element to it rather than the reserve fund, is that ending fund balance that's there that we haven't spent gives us a cushion so that if our revenue goes down, we can cover expenses, because automatically that ending fund balance disappears. Mm-hmm. If we were like in the old days when we would leave a long session, we might have $30 million in ending fund balance, we would be in trouble quite quickly. Mm-hmm. Just with modest fluctuation in revenue. So, but I do think this discussion is very worthwhile to continue, and I hope that we can do that. So we'll look forward to the report, and then we'll have the discussion with the presiding officers. And I'll switch roles. I never actually do this. Mr. Bailey, do you have any questions of the committee?
Would it surprise you to know that I'm not prepared for that? I would just ask, given the kicker law and given some of the restrictions that you face unique budgetary restrictions in terms of fiscal flexibility because of the kicker law, would something like Utah does, would something that's just more generally guiding you in the budget documents, knowing what is above trend or below trend as you are entering the budget process, yeah, would that help at all, or would that be completely not useful?
Are you speaking of trend in the sense of where revenues are going?
I'm speaking in terms of growth trend, where,
yeah,
what revenue, at least in terms of maybe a 10-year growth trend, or you can build out different growth trends. What is above the normal level of growth, and if revenue is below the normal level of growth?
I think it would be beneficial. I think also, as we have discussions about adjusting our, where our revenue is coming from. Some of the portions of that adjustments are our volatility in terms of being just almost purely an income tax, you know, has its minuses. And in a sense, its pluses sometimes, because you can see our spikes in revenue were much higher. But some of the revenue that we've talked about in the past of replacing some of that revenue with doesn't grow as fast or isn't as volatile. I hate to use this example, but the measure that was on the ballot that was soundly defeated by voters, that was going to be actually a slower growing revenue source than income tax would be normally. Mm-hmm. And we would have had to have adjusted to that.
Yeah.
Because our expectation would have to be lower in terms of what the revenue growth would be. But I think a lot of this actually deserves a lot more discussion and a lot more in detail than what we can do here today. So.
Well, I do thank you very much for your time, Chairman and Chairwoman. This has been a pleasure to come out here again. And any help you need, Pew, we'll gladly try to assist as much as we can. And again, I really appreciate your time and really thoughtful questions. So thank you.
Well, thank you for you coming out. Thank you for all the staff that has done work on this. And thank you to the members of the committee. And with that, we're adjourned and we're back in session tomorrow morning.
Mr. Bader, could you put your contact information up there?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. Information up there?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. Put your